Welcome back to The Bilbao Effect, the podcast series asking the question, can culture boost economic development? I'm your host, Seth O'Farrell, FDI's global investment reporter. And in this episode, we'll be looking at the Tate Modern in London. One of the most emblematic and recognisable art museums in the world, the Tate Modern needs little introduction. It has been celebrated for heralding a non-chronological approach to the display of modern and contemporary art, and its installations in the Turbine Hall have become legendary. From Oliafor Eliasson's Weather Project and Rachel White-Reed's Cubes, to the current display of Anika Yee's Floating Air Ropes. The Tate Modern's industrial surroundings were no accident. When the Tate had outgrown its collection at Millbank, where the Tate Britain now stands, it chose the Bankside Power Station as a site for its new art gallery. Originally designed by Sir Giles Gilbert Scott, the power station was completed in the 1960s, but decommissioned in the 1980s. Swiss architects Herzog and de Meuron were employed to turn the building into a gallery, with the Turbine Hall becoming the entrance and boiler rooms the gallery spaces. Touted as being a museum for the new millennium, the Tate Modern has become an inherent part of London's cityscape and cultural scene, and is one of the UK's biggest tourist attractions, bringing in an estimated £100 million a year in economic benefits. But parallel to its cultural prowess, the Tate Modern has also witnessed considerable urban regeneration efforts on London's waterfront, creating a sort of Tate effect. With me to discuss all of this is Francis Morris, director of the Tate Modern. Francis was also head of displays in the early 2000s, curating the new gallery spaces when they first opened 20 years ago. She's a formidable voice on the global art circuit, and it is an honour and privilege to welcome her to the Bilbao Effect. Francis, welcome to the show.
An honour and a privilege to be with you.
And you're also very exciting. You're my first live guest for the Bilbao Effect. As I mentioned in my introduction, you've long been involved in the Tate, and you were there at the very beginning when the Tate Modern first opened. Can you first walk us through a bit the plans to find and develop the site?
Yes, of course. I feel very nostalgic for that era when everything seemed possible. We'd massively outgrown our site at Millbank. There was a kind of a huge time lag between the feel of the museum, what we could do with the art, and the current state of contemporary art in Britain at that time. You know, it was the era of the YBAs and this rising generation of amazing Black British artists. People were working video and digital, and a kind of a whole new world was out there, and we couldn't deal with it at Millbank in our old kind of citadel museum. So trustees took the decision in early 1990s that we should expand. And original ideas were to expand on the site, but very quickly it became apparent that we needed a second site in London. And there were various parameters. It had to be quite close to Millbank. You know, we were a child of Millbank. We were the baby, so we needed to be nurtured by the mother institution. We also had recently opened a major storage facility on the Old Kent Road. So we were looking for sites, you know, in those vicinities. At that time, we had a group of trustees, including two very strong artist voices, Michael Craig Martin and Bill Woodrow. And they took it upon themselves to do a trip to see other new museums. Of course, this is an era where all across Europe and North America, people have got museum plans. And it was not so long after the launch of Pompidou Centre, for example, mm-hmm. in Paris, and Bilbao was already on its way. And they came back with serious concerns about new builds and a real interest in us finding an existing building. And we had history there with our development of Tate Liverpool, where we'd taken a warehouse site in the docks, and that had been enormously successful, both as an institution, but also culturally in the city. So there were a number of ambitions coming together to find a space for art, to impact in the city, to build culture for London, for Londoners, and to do something that would have a kind of statement of intent for the future of contemporary art and the public for art in London.
But it was important that it was a brownfield site.
It was very important that it was a brownfield. It had to be a brownfield site because we were looking at central London. Mm-hmm. You know, it really needed to be in the centre. We looked at a number of sites that didn't have buildings on them that we could have used. Jubilee Gardens, for example. Mm-hmm. I think we looked in Greenwich, Vauxhall, King's Cross. Interestingly, all areas that had subsequently had developments. And we looked at a number of specific buildings. We looked at Alexandra Palace, and we looked at Battersea Arts Centre, and then we landed on the moon, which and the moon was Bankside Power Station. And it was just like a building so prominent and so visible that it was absolutely invisible.
Mm-hmm.
I was a frequent visitor to Southwark. As a child, I sang in Southwark Cathedral. There was the tourist landmarks of the city. I'd never heard of Bankside Power Station. But it was a glorious edifice, controversial, derided by some, loved by others, on a fantastically large site, 7 acres in pretty central London, right on the river, opposite St Paul's. It was a kind of no-brainer.
And difficult to imagine also without the Millennium Bridge, which now sort of provides an entranceway too.
Yes, but I mean, I think you have already, this is the 1990s, the millennium was coming. There was already talk about what were the projects that the UK would fund and support to mark that millennium, to celebrate the past, but also to kind of anticipate the future. So there was this growing plan for cultural development along the Thames. Not far after us, plans became apparent for the Millennium Wheel.
Mm-hmm.
For the London Eye, the Millennium Bridge came on track. The Globe was just going to open in, I think, 97.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a kind of, we knew that we would be part of a articulation of a generation. There were plans for a tube in Southwark. So all the things that we needed, the kind of infrastructure to bring people in and other attractions to lure people to the area, seemed to provide sufficient kind of robust context mm-hmm. for Bankside to be a goer.
Mm-hmm. And so it was touted, as I mentioned in my introduction, as a museum for the new millennium. Has that changed, that meaning, from then to now?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, people are still talking and writing books about what does the museum of the 21st century look like?
Mm.
And I think that is still a valid question, because we're always, you know, we're always thinking about what next. But I think what was interesting about the ambitions for Tate Modern is that the ambition was not to replicate what we felt was a outmoded model, the kind of 19th century classical museum,
mm-hmm.
and not to replicate not just its look and its structure and its architecture and its feel, but not to replicate the kind of structures and systems and assumptions and values that underpinned it. And I think you could see that most tangibly in the new Tate Modern, in the way we moved away from a chronology. We moved away from that sense that history is a given, that it's a canon, that it will always unfold in the same way. Another thing that we did is we decided, unlike most other museums, to do away with the kind of formal divisions between media.
Mm-hmm.
And another key thing was, I think, too, which was connected to both of them, to accept that at the beginning of a new century, it simply wasn't possible to tell one story.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was about museums, or our museum, catching up with 3 decades of amazing work in the humanities. We were responding to feminism. We were responding to kind of post-colonial studies. We wanted to give a voice to Black British artists. We wanted to have a broader conversation around art. And above all, we didn't want to replace one system with another. So there was right at the beginning this idea that we would not have a permanent display, that Tate Modern would be a place for permanent disruption. So almost like a laboratory. I mean, this sounds very idealistic, but we would look and think again and again and try things out. And one of the really amazing things, I think, about being in Tate Modern over this last 20 years is that sense that we can change the way we do things, that we can reflect and move on, has been continuous. And actually, I think that is a very powerful message about what the 21st century needed. It needed responsiveness, it needed flexibility, it needed to be attuned to the moment and to revalue and reevaluate what you do all mm-hmm. the time.
And staying on that theme then, what was the regeneration impact of the museum on the surrounding area, on the waterfront? Is it, you mentioned there's a lot of effort that sort of, you know, that the Tate was a part of. It was by no means its one single catalyst. But did the museum itself have an impact on the surrounding area, do you think?
I think it had undoubtedly had an immediate and pretty radical impact. I mean, when we first went to Tate Modern, there was nothing. There was a greasy spoon. There was a bar. I mean, within weeks, months of us arriving, and of course, with roots that go back into the period of its development, there was a pretty significant expansion of the kind of commercial and business offer. I think over the first year, a huge number of people poured into to Bankside as visitors, and that had a massive impact on just the economy of Southwark. I think in Bankside, something like 50 to 70 million ancillary spend came from visitors in the first year. So on the back of Tate Modern came a whole range of independent kind of entrepreneurial initiatives. But what was really, I think, really telling was that Southwark as a council and Bankside as a neighbourhood were both extremely invested in ensuring that the development was appropriate and sensitive and kind of culturally powerful. And that gave us a really great opportunity from, you know, several years before we opened to be very involved in conversations about what the neighbourhood would feel like. So we were particularly right from the start conscious that we needed to serve the local community, the neighbours, who the living population, as well as to support the growing and burgeoning business population. And that, I think, one of the things we felt very attentive to was the need to build public landscape, for example. I mean, Bankside is an incredibly aggressively urban neighbourhood. So our landscape very much became part of a kind of this notion of an urban forest that we worked on over several years with Better Bankside, which was the business district that was set up in the wake of our development.
Can you tell me a bit about that, the Bankside Urban Forest initiative, and what that meant?
Well, I think it very simply meant recognising that there was very little open space in the neighbourhood, and that every little bit of urban space mattered. And so there was a piece of planning that was undertaken in collaboration between us and local constituents and stakeholders, working with a number of different architectural practices to design sensitively and ensure that as the neighbourhood developed, we would preserve and love and pay attention to every bit of open green space that there was. I think it's one of the success stories, but also, and we may come to this later, it's one of the things that, you know, there is a kind of, in all these neighbourhoods in London, a creeping privatisation which continues to threaten that.
Mm-hmm. And so can we call this a Tate effect? In contrast to the Bill Bower effect, is there something specific about the Tate effect, do you think, given what we've just said?
Well, I mean, Bill Bower, I think, clearly had a major international impact on a city. You have to see Tate Modern as part of an overall development across London. And whether how significant Tate Modern was outside of that is quite difficult to tell. I mean, mm-hmm. it has certainly become a huge international icon, and it's put London on the cultural map. I think that part of Southwark, North Southwark, the continuation of the South Bank, which was the whole Millennium Mile, would have happened whatever. And there were—you have to remember that historically there were a number of quite strong ideas around how to develop the power station itself. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want to overclaim for that, but undoubtedly we were part of a really strong collaboration. That was a collaboration between public and private, a collaboration with many individuals who felt passionate about the neighbourhood, mm-hmm. and corporations. And I think in that regard, it's a very successful example of a kind of, let's call it Tate Modern effect.
Okay, the Tate Modern effect. And you mentioned located in Southwark, which is also one of the most deprived boroughs in the country, if I'm not mistaken. So I wondered, what has Tate Modern done to engage with the local community specifically?
Well, I think Tate Modern, one of the first appointments, long before I was appointed to the curatorial project, was a local community liaison officer. And there was very much a feeling that we should not parachute into this neighbourhood, mm-hmm. where we had no historic connections at all. And there were long-standing vested interests. The Globe was the kind, I think Globe were very worried about us coming because they were the kind of landmark institution. And there were, you know, at that time, there were, as you say, Southwark was a very deprived borough, still is a very deprived borough. And around the power station itself, there were pockets of deep deprivation. And it was very important that we should make friends with those communities and keep them up to speed and involve them in the conversations. And so we had this great officer in place who had, you know, set up, I think we had an open space, we had a visitor centre. It was very, very transparent for that time. And as soon as myself and Ivona Blaswick, now director at the Whitechapel, were appointed as to the curatorial team and a learning curator, Cara Howell, our first task was not to think about 2000, it was to think about what do we do in 1998. So, for example, we had an open submission exhibition for local artists, for artists who live within a mile of Tate Modern. We did some big public programmes on the front of the building. We projected film programmes that were, we absolutely reached out to local communities to come. Cara Howell worked with the dance group Coralie. And at a time when it was a quite a scary place, the walkway at that time. So we tried to begin to make relationships with local people and sort of test out the way that people would want to work with us. So we did a great project with the artist Mark Dion, working with seniors from community centres in the neighbourhood, but also with students from Southwark College. Mm-hmm. And this was a sort of archaeological dig on the beach at Bankside and wow. the beach at Millbank.
That was in what year?
That was in 1998-99.
Okay, just before the museum itself opened.
Yeah, so we embedded kind of art practice and the idea of a museum without walls, mm-hmm. and like a museum beyond the museum. Before then, the museum came into the building in order, in a way, it's like a lure, or mm-hmm. make friends so that then they want to come to the party.
And did it work? Has over the last, now fast forward to 20 years, has it had a net, you know, positive impact on the community, do you think? And are there other ways that you can sort of speak to that?
I think positive is an odd word. We've had a continuous relationship with our neighbours. And their neighbours are very diverse groups mm-hmm. of communities. And the neighbourhood profile has changed massively. And that's one of, I would say, arguably a negative benefit. But we've never stopped having a relationship with those neighbours. They're often very vocal. They're often very critical. All weekend I get emails from neighbours complaining about skateboarders. And I get emails from neighbours complaining about the noise from the pleasure cruises going up and down the river. But we also get neighbours who come in and say, we want to be your friends. We want you to do things for us. And so, and I like the idea that the relationships are abrasive. We listen and we respond when we can. And then there are one or two things that we do together. We have a community garden, which staff and community share. And it's an absolute oasis, totally secret, and has a little spoken password, which I'm not going to share with your listeners. But
oh, wow.
So the neighbours are very much part of the conversation. They are the first people to come in to see when we do major projects. They were the first people invited in after lockdowns. And we have named our boiler house, Natalie Bell, after a community leader, who's an amazing woman who is very involved in Coin Street Workshop just along the river. And her name is just as valued and celebrated as the name of Len Blavatnik, who was the great financial philanthropist who funded our Blavatnik building.
And speaking about neighbours and indeed the Blavatnik building, and also if we fast forward a bit to the sort of encroachment of sort of privatisation, there was a lawsuit a couple of years ago between the property owners of Neo Bankside next to the Tate and Tate, where the residents complained that the new viewing platform in the Switch House was invasion of privacy. Is this an example of where the sort of openness that you talk about, the museum without walls, quite literally, collides with contiguous private enterprises or private commercial and adventures?
Yes, I mean, I think I'm absolutely, and it's deeply problematic. And we have a very, very small number of people. I mean, really, I think 3, 4, 5 individuals in this wonderful Rogers development near Bankside who feel deeply imperiled by the gaze of our many millions of visitors who visit our 360-degree wraparound viewing platform, because the only view of Westminster is through their buildings. And, of course, they are living in iconic architectural edifices that speak to the 21st century. And there will always be, we will always rub up against tensions between the public and private, and the private perception of their, what matters to them and their privacy. And our, my absolute resolute commitment that we as a public institution are there to serve the public. And the lawsuit continues.
But is that a risk, a greater risk going forward, where there'll just be more antagonism between private residents and museums? I'm not just talking about the Tate Modern, I mean elsewhere also, as the this is the sort of the flip side of the Bilbao effect, if you will, or the Bilbao effect we talk about in very positive terms, that culture can boost economic development. But also, of course, economic development also brings with it private buildings, you know, big fancy apartments.
It's complicated. I mean, we work very closely with Southwark Council, who are brilliant. I have nothing but respect for them. It's a very poor borough. It still is. I mean, it's no longer, the sixth most deprived. It might be the 16th most deprived, but it is a really challenging part of London, and with many, many needy people. Now, the kind of economic developments that they can make in North Southwark, along the river, on the back of what we've done at Tate Modern, and because they are on the river and have extraordinary views of St Paul's, is incredibly important to the borough in facilitating regeneration and supporting elsewhere. Needy communities elsewhere in the borough. And I, it's really important, however much I regret those massive developments, which I think do denude the neighbourhood of texture. And actually, they're mostly empty, so they're not full
Indeed.
Of people.
You don't see many people in those
flats.
I mean,
they are investment properties. Mm. I can see the logic from the borough's point of view. I mean, the real tragedy is planning laws in this country.
Mm.
And that there isn't an overall sense of how we develop our neighbourhoods and how we ensure that there are mixed developments and there's sufficient open space and that all neighbourhoods welcome all people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a regret there, but it's not that we haven't done our best to influence those developments. And ironically, the Neobankside development, which is now, we've just been in the Supreme Court with those neighbours, was developed in very close collaboration between the architectural practices and planning. We thought it was an exemplary move forward. It is simply the fact that the residents in those buildings do not feel that they should protect themselves by blinds or net curtains.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about very privileged people. And if I have one worry about the Bilbao effect, the Tate Modern effect, is that how do institutions that then become part of economic and cultural regenerations prevent themselves from privileging the privileged?
Mm. And speaking about that a little bit more, and perhaps also about the way that the art world has changed or the way the funding models have changed, as a public institution, the Tate Modern has become increasingly reliant on private funding, as is the case for many national museums in this country, and indeed I'm sure will become more and more the case in Europe post-pandemic. Does that concern you too, that there's a sort of semi-privatisation, or that funds have to come from private sources, also just to exhibit exhibitions, to show exhibitions?
Well, for Tate, there's nothing new in that, because although we had really supportive funding from the Millennium Commission for Tate Modern, from the early 90s onwards, Tate was sort of almost a kind of leader in being entrepreneurial in funding and fundraising its own growth. And it is absolutely classic sort of victim of neoliberalism and its success, is that now we face this, as the public purse shrinks, the proportion of fundraising we have to take on ourselves gets bigger and bigger. But I think it has to be said that the public purse does not come without strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
So, all funding comes with, a baggage of requirements and KPIs and messages, and so we're in a kind of we're in a perfect storm of conflicting interests. What worries me more than anything else is the uncertainty and roller coaster impact of being overly reliant on both self-generated income in the form of ticket sales and funders, and we're very vulnerable. And it means that planning long term can be very difficult. I mean, Tate Modern's in a very good place at the moment because we have very, very great long term commitment from Hyundai across two major projects. And we also, I think, across Tate, have an incredibly robust membership base. So the question is, moving forward, how can we create a funding base that does not present us with the kind of conflicts of interest that currently museums are confronting in, you know, the reputational association with, I mean, over the years, BP caused us great anxiety, but also the Sacklers at the moment, for example. How can we protect ourselves from too close association with contentious funders, and also ethically, you know, keep that distance. It's not just the reputation; it's that we strongly believe we need need a strong moral compass in what we do. So there
Indeed,
is
a, strings have come attached, yeah, basically in public funds and in private funds.
Absolutely, but there must be a new way of doing it. So part of that, the Museum of the 21st Century, is how do you make that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that we can't continue with the growth rate. That's unlikely. But the challenge is, how do we change the business model to invest more of our resources in what we really value and less just in the money-making machine?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fascinating and complex rethinking of the model, but it's something that we're absolutely up for, and we're not doing it on our own.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that post-pandemic, then, there'll be more focus on sorts of things that we're discussing, local engagement and sort of potential reputational risk, over the kind of the glitz and glam of the porousness between the museum world and the art market world?
Yeah,
so between Frieze and, you know, all these things that we've seen over the last 10 years,
yeah,
for instance.
I mean, absolutely. And I love that word porous. When we opened Tate Modern in 2000, there was a porosity, and it wasn't between the art market and the museum. It was between the public, the city, and the museum. And the Turbine Hall was envisaged as a kind of street to bring the city in. And that is still there. And over the last, there's green shoots of hope here. The last couple of years, it's been an amazing place that kind of calm activists have come and used, and we felt very happy to welcome them. You know, Culture Declares and Ben Ockrey, the poet, did an amazing project. It was an absolutely pitch perfect work of art, but it happened. We hosted it. So that porosity, I think we need to switch from the sense of the fact that we'd be permeated by the art market and commerce, switch to revalue what we do. And there are different registers of value at play in the museum. There's the financial value, there's the aesthetic value, there's the instrumental value. So the key things I think we have to think about in light of the fact that COVID has made us vulnerable, but climate and ecological emergency are making us even more vulnerable. So how can we be, in light of that, we can't just be about art. We have to be outside that bubble. And we are outside it in this building and in that place. So how can we be responsible, really responsible in a kind of planetary sense? How can we be responsive to local people and their needs? And I think that for me, is very exciting. And we have all the potential to do that, but we need to, the third R is the resourcing. And it's about that rebalancing.
But nonetheless, you think you're going to almost return to the sorts of initiatives that were first there in the late 90s when Tate Modern was first sort of formed, that there'll be more active engagement with the community away from the art market, if you sort of sketch out a broader narrative of the last 20 years?
Well, I would like, yes, I think that is the case. I mean, I'll give you an example. During the summer, we made a project with funding from Uniqlo, so that's a commercial sponsor, but that was entirely focused on families, intergenerational audiences from the local community. It cost probably a third, less than a third, of the budget of a temporary exhibition, of loans, principally serving adult audiences with degrees, so the privileged who pay tickets, a free offer in the Turbine Hall over the summer, entirely collaborative, participatory, but based in deep research into and based on a Japanese project made in the 1950s by the avant-garde group Gutai informed by research from our research centre, over 300,000 young people, intergenerational kids and their parents, from I think 6 months to 90 years old, all participated, the most diverse in terms of socioeconomic and race audience that we've ever had at Tate Modern. Absolutely demonstrate that you can shift the engagement. We just have to have the power to do it, the willpower to do it.
And you mentioned climate change. And if we think again about how the sort of the Tate Modern effect is something, or the Tate Modern is bringing us into the new millennium, to what extent does climate feature as the sort of highest concern, or climate change feature on the highest concern of the Tate Modern's programme or engagement with the world going forward?
Well, for me, it's possibly the most important thing. And one of the most important, one of the reasons it is that climate is not just about emissions. It's about the intersections of all sorts of planetary crises, from race equality to social equity to north-south global inequality. It's where it all impacts. And the climate emergency will highlight and exacerbate all those things. And forget the art bit for the moment. We are an institution that has spent 21 years building relationships all over the world, and especially in areas that are going to be majorly impacted by climate, whether it's Latin America or Africa or across South Asia. And we have friends, professional friends, we have patron friends, we have artist friends who are part of our global network. And at this moment in time, in a crisis, you have to take care of your friends. So the idea of the local is for us a distributed local. We have Bankside as our neighbourhood, but we have neighbourhoods in Dhaka, in Bangladesh, or in Rio. And therefore, we have to think, how do we adjust our behaviours and our activities to mitigate and adapt. So that we future, so that culture continues to be relevant. Otherwise, we're just dust.
Mm-hmm. And there's a powerful metaphor, I suppose, in having you housed in a power station for the next part of the 21st century, where climate, as you say, the climate emergency will become more and more important, and the ways that local communities and global communities are interlinked on that basis.
Yeah, isn't it interesting, the metaphors that come out of the power station? And there's a great TV series when we opened called Power into Art. But you have to remember that the power station was decommissioned in the 1980s because of the price of oil, but also it was a big polluting, thing. So, there's a horrible metaphor there. If we don't, we really need to be part of the greening, the cleansing. Mm. And we need to be absolutely key to the solution, and not to be just something that goes on polluting with our high emissions and our ill-conceived messages. I mean, it's a bit of a...
There's a danger that you're still a walking power station. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think it's just, what do you do with that power?
Right.
Where do you deploy your energy? And we need to deploy our energy in a way that's green, that's positive, that's healing, mm-hmm. that's promotes well-being, that is an exemplar across the world, that's welcoming, and that is a giver, not just a taker.
Frances Morris, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe to FDI Podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we're heading to the north of the UK, where we'll be speaking to Claire McColgan, Director of Culture Liverpool. Hope you can join us then.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.